and you got to be alone, indoors, don't exercise, don't go outside. I mean, I will not swear on your channel, but they cannot go to hell fast enough. And no, I will not forgive and forget, ever.
I am a husband, a father, a lawyer, a Christian, and a proud Canadian. I started this series because it was clear that our nation needs truth. Not just another biased narrative, but real information of substance. We need access to facts and the freedom to think for ourselves. I'm Leighton Gray, and this is Gray Matter.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to another episode of Gray Matter. Well, if you're paying attention, if you're a follower of the show, you'll notice that I've got a new background today. That's sort of in honor of our guest. If you're watching really closely, you'll see that my tie has kind of a legal theme. That's also in honor of our guest, who is a lawyer, a colleague in the court. We call him a friend, but he's much more than that. In fact, he's left the full-time practice of law and has transitioned into one of the most incredibly successful media careers, media platforms in the world. And he's now reaching many people in Canada and the United States and really everywhere on something called Viva Fry. And his name is David Fryheit. Welcome to the program, David. It's a real pleasure to have you on. I've been looking forward to this conversation for quite a
Thank
while.
Thank you very much, Leighton. I'm having a debate with my brother. I relinquished my bar license in Quebec because I was paying thousands of dollars a year so that people could file anonymous ethics complaints because they didn't like my tweets. So I don't know if I get to call myself a lawyer anymore. I say former litigator turned current rumbler. I still have my law degree. Where is it? Oh, actually, that's my undergrad in philosophy. But so I don't know if I get to call myself a lawyer anymore. But bottom line, I practiced from 2007 to 2022. So I have enough experience to have trained me, but not enough to have destroyed my soul.
Yes,
well, and hopefully.
And of course, all of that all that education, that background comes to the fore during your show. Before we introduce you properly, as we always do on this show, we have some framing aphorisms. These are chosen somewhat in your honor. Hopefully you're not offended by these. The first is from G.K. Chesterton, who wrote, "Right is right, even if nobody does it. Wrong is wrong, even if everybody is wrong about it." The second one is from Confucius, who wrote, "Our greatest glory is not in never falling, but in rising every time we fall." And the last one we have is actually from you. You were quoted, I got this off the internet. "Life moves quickly. Don't stick to something for 10 years if you know you hate it after 5. So who do we have on the show today? Well, his name is David Fryheit. He's mentioned, he's a former Canadian lawyer, we'll call him that. But he grew up in Montreal. The youngest of 5 siblings into a Jewish family, and he enjoyed creating videos. He's obviously done a lot with that and with the creative arts now. But he received his Bachelor of Arts at McGill University. He then received his civil law degree from University Laval, where he was the editor-in-chief of the university's law journal. I can tell you from being at law school, that's a tough job. That's a big deal. So he practiced law for 15 years, as he described. But since then, he started his own law firm and became Fryheit Legal. But more recently, he took a deep dive into YouTube. And now, I guess within the last couple of years, really signed an historic contract with Rumble. So his show, Viva Fry, which reaches hundreds of thousands of people, millions really around the world, is now exclusively on Rumble. And David, I want to start off with a question. Your name translates auf Deutsch to freedom. How interesting is that, since you talk so much about this on your program, and a lot of what you do is really aimed at addressing the attack upon freedom and free speech that we're experiencing around the world.
I don't know what the expression was. It's nomen est omen, like there's an omen in a name. But yeah, the verbatim, Freiheit means freedom in German or Germanic languages, Yiddish.
Right.
And my grandfather's original last name was Freiheiter, Freiheiter, which means freedom fighter. And I guess it's the irony that he didn't, I say he fled for freedom. He left Poland in 1936 and dropped the ER for whatever the reason, but there's still some Freiheiters out there. So yeah, you know, it definitely is a good name. I've always loved it up in Canada. I think, you know, growing up, there were 8 Freiheit families in Canada. And I think we were of the only Jewish ones because it's a German last name, not typically a Jewish one. Mm-hmm. But youngest of 5 kids, all of us except one have turned out to be lawyers or got into the practice of law. My father's a lawyer. The in-laws are lawyers. So it was a family of law. My mom was a teacher and then retired and raised 5 kids. You know, we grew up in a perfectly normal household to some extent. My dad was working, you know, 24/7 to support and the lives of 5 kids. But you know, it's a normal upbringing. I was a bit of a troublemaker as a kid, which probably translates into being somewhat of a questioning adult if you don't just necessarily do what people tell you to do. So makes for a troublesome, maybe a turmoil-ish childhood growing up, but what is a problem as a child sometimes becomes an asset as an adult.
Yeah, and you know, talking about Poland, we had a guest recently on the show who is a German intellectual named Rainier Tittelman. He's just written a book called How Nations Escape Poverty. He was one of the nations he profiles in that book is Poland, which has undergone an incredible success story, incredible transition. Through really reintroduction of capitalism and freedom to become one of the most prosperous nations in the world. But in 1936, we all know what was going on in Poland. Obviously, your ancestors were very wise to get out of Poland in that time. But I wonder, did that shape sort of the ethos of your family, you know, coming out of Poland during that dreadful time?
Well, it's interesting. I mean, my grandmother was born, so we're all Eastern European. I mean, I don't really put too much emphasis in any of my content on religion. It's, I mean, I was born Jewish, family Jewish going back. We were Kohens, you know, going back 5,000 years. My grandmother, originally, her family was from Ukraine. Mm. She came over her family came over in 1896, give or take. My grandmother was the first and only one born of her family in Canada. Grandfather came from Poland. On my mother's side, Romanian and Eastern European as well. But now hold on one second, Leighton. I just forgot the question. The question was, having come from...
Right. How did that shape sort of your worldview and, well, and sort I, of no, your no, family's culture?
My grandfather died when I was 2, so I never really got to know him. My grandmother lived to 103. She wasn't so much shaped by the events of you know, Europe and war. More so by the events of the Great Depression in Canada. Okay. Always grew up very, very frugal, always worried about being able to provide for herself and for her family. But my dad grew up working 24/7, the kid of immigrants. He didn't grow up with very much. He had one sister, my aunt, and they didn't grow up in a very opulent, they grew up, I wouldn't say poor, but definitely not rich. My grandfather, grandmother had a fur business, worked very hard. My dad was, you know, grew up somewhat alone. So I'd say the Great Depression more shaped my grandmother and, you know, to her 100-year birthday, was always worried about not having as opposed to being spoiled. And so, you know, grateful for what she had. But the fleeing of a country is interesting because when COVID hit and none of us have ever lived through anything like this. And I remember sitting down with my dad in, you know, within the 2 weeks to flatten the curve and the world was disintegrating. I'm like, this is wild. And he says, well, now you can see how societies get whipped up into frenzies that are inexplicable frenzies. And as we kept on having discussions, at some point I'm like, you know, at what point do I have to leave? And he says, well, it's not so bad. Canada's not that bad yet. You're exaggerating. It's not full communism. It's not full tyranny. And then at some point it's like, I could see the analogies where if you wait too late, it's too late. And if you leave too early, I don't know, you know, maybe you're panicking, but I understand my grandfather was the only one of his 25 family members to leave Poland. They were all religious Jews. So they're all like, this will pass. It's as bad as it's going to get. And he was the only one who wasn't quite religious enough to not be able to leave. And he fled and the 24 others that stayed all perished. And so it's interesting. I mean, you could see how life has cycles like that, where not that Canada 2024 is like Poland 1936 in distance and extremity, but you see how societies fall very slowly then all at once. I, you know, we had this discussion with my father. I'm you know, we left for other reasons, not because it's cataclysmic, you know, 1930s level Nazi Germany. And I don't want to put a butt to that, but I'm going to put a butt to that. When the government starts freezing bank accounts, legislating what you can and can't do, criminalizing speech with, you know, or at least attempting to, at some point you say, this is not where I see a future for me or my kids.
Mm-hmm. That's a very fascinating history. And it sort of it segues into my next question. That is, here's your father who worked tremendously hard, assiduously to create this culture, sort of this white collar culture. And your family, enormously successful family, you're all lawyers. And then at some point you say, well, yeah, that's great. I've been there, done that. Now I want to do something different. I'm going to go off. And I realize it wasn't just a career move. I understand it was also an intentional move to focus on your family. You're a father, and to spend more time with your daughter. But how was that received by your father and your siblings that you sort of stepped away from this new tradition that he had cultivated for the family? Was that a difficult time, or did he support your move into media?
Well, I remember the lunch with my dad where I was in tears and he said, you obviously can't live like this. But it was again, everything, it's all slow and then it's cataclysmic at the end. Like, it happened slowly, then all at once. Growing up, we were always into making video. Like, back in the day, we would prank calls and record our calls. And back before you had VHS, or when you had VHS, but you had those cassettes, you could record calls, and we were creating content like that. It just, we didn't have the means to publish it or disseminate it the way we do today. But we always were into that. Then we had, the camcorder that went on your shoulder. We would make videos. We would, bike down the street with the camera 3 inches off the ground and make our own action videos like that. And I always been into it. Got my camera when I was 14 years old, a Canon AE-1, like an old film camera. Said I would never get into digital film. And then my dad gave me his Nikon. What's it? I think it's the F. Well, the first digital camera that came out that was like quasi-professional. I think it was a Nikon D1. Got into digital photography. I've always been into it. And when I studied at CEGEP at Dawson College, I did fine arts and film. And then, you have to put aside the childhood passions or the childhood pastimes and get a real degree, get a philosophy degree. But it was not in order to philosophize. It was strictly to go into law afterwards, because I knew that was my trajectory. Mm-hmm. You get into law, you spend 4 years with your undergrad, 4 years with law training, bar, passing the bar, stat, or internship. And then you start practicing and you're like, there's an expression, the biggest lie you can tell yourself is, when I get what I want, I'll be happy. And so you finally get there. Like, you graduate law school, you pass the bar exam. I passed with a 60, and I got a job offer at Borden Ladner Gervais. And it's like, that's it. You've reached the 1% of what aspiring law students hope to get.
Yes.
And then you do it and you're like, is this it? All right. I can get nice ties now and wear a suit and show up to the office. And then you're like, is this it? And then I was like, okay, I'll give it another 6 months. And then you do 6 months, and then I get hired back at the law firm. And you're like, holy cows, this is the new pinnacle. And then you do that for 6 months. Like, is this all the practice of law has to offer? You're a young lawyer. You're highlighting. You're doing research. It's glamorous and novel until it's no longer glamorous and novel. And then you start to get to, handle your own files. And you realize it's like not a thankless job. It pays well, but it felt empty for me, at least. From day one. And it was never better the next day than the day before. So I said, okay, I'll do my stage and I get hired back. I'll work for 6 months. If it's not better in 6 months, I'll find something else. 6 months turns into a year. Then you get married and you're like, okay, you just got married and you can't do this now. Then you buy a house. You're like, okay, you just bought a house. You can't do this now. Then you have a kid and you're like, well, I certainly can't do it now. I got a mortgage. I got a kid. My wife is relying on me. But then at some point, I remember the day it was culmination. Kids born, I'm not sleeping. I'm going to the office, 8-9 hours a day, leave when the kid is sleeping, come back when the kid is sleeping, not seeing my own newborn kid as she in any waking sense. And then at one point I'm like looking out the window. I was like, if this is it, in 10 years, I'm either going to be miserable or dead from a heart attack. And I went to see my mentor and I said, I just can't do this anymore. And that's it. What the hell was I thinking? I mean, in debt, mortgage, and a new kid. And so I figured I'll go back to Dawson College and study commercial photography. And so I apply, and before I could even get rejected, I was put on the waiting list, and I guess ultimately rejected because I didn't think that they thought how old was I at the time? Like a 30 some odd year old man with a law degree and a family is going to go into commercial photography. But before I could even get rejected, I start getting calls and like, you're on your own. How much do you charge? It's like, I don't know, $150 an hour, which was amazing. No overhead. That's virtually 150 net. It's like, okay. And then that's the cheapest anybody's ever had a lawyer for. And I got all the training. I was at, you know, Canada's biggest law firm in terms of number of lawyers. Mm-hmm. And so that then built up into my own solo practice, which itself was more rewarding because when you get to pick your files, drop mm-hmm. your clients, you know, when you get to do things the way you want to right. do and the way you think it's ethical to do it, it's more liberating. It's your business. You put your time and your blood, sweat, and tears into it. You deal with your clients. You build it up. Everything. You open up bank accounts. Rent an office. Hire paralegals. So it is your baby to some extent. It's your own creation. But it was never on a substantive level any more fulfilling for me than it was the mm-hmm. day before.
Yeah.
And it was equally as soul crushing. And then you get into the actual practice of law. I won't say corruption in the sense of what we're seeing in politics, but what is the practice of law? Some lawyers get more credibility than others, regardless of whether or not they're more honest. Judges are people too, and personalities conflict regardless of the substance of the law. You can pour your heart and soul into a file, know that you're right, and then a judge has a bad day and says, no, you're wrong, and then whatever. Soul crushing. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. so while all that's happening at the same time, I this is where it all started. I got a GoPro in 2014, and I discovered, I got my GoPro lying around the table somewhere. I just discovered, going back to childhood, except now the VHS camera is 2.5 inches by 1 inch and fits in your pocket. And, I started doing everything, slapping the GoPro on toboggans, taking it with my kids. And then I started realizing that you could sell, you put these videos on the internet and you can make money doing it. The squirrel video, the squirrel
steals the GoPro. Famous squirrel video. Yes.
That changed the trajectory of my entire life. I put this video, I go to the Westmount Park, put a piece of bread on a GoPro, tape it down. A squirrel takes it, carries it up a tree, eats it, drops the camera, and falls out of the tree. I pick it up, push the button. I go upload it to YouTube. Within a week, it had 5 million views. I start getting calls from news agencies. Do we want to interview you? Like, tell us what happened. And then, and it made like a few thousand bucks from that video. And I was like, holy crab apples, video licensing is a thing. Viral videos are a thing. I got a drone and then just started making silly videos over the course of several years, but always had to make sure that, I didn't do anything compromising to the practice because I'm still a practicing attorney. So when a judge sees a lawyer waxing his legs with a drone, it might reflect poorly on his client. And so I discovered that entire thing at the same time. And then give or take 2016, 2017, said, I'm going to wind up the litigation side because I don't want to do this in 10 years. And if you don't jump off the cliff, you're never going to grow your wings. Mm-hmm. And I kept a few clients to pay the bills and to meet basic necessities and tried marketing, kept on doing the video thing on YouTube. And then I periodically would make a video about a day in the life of a lawyer because I had a couple of files left. So I was like, oh, okay, I'm prepping for trial today. I'll make a silly vlog and show people what it's like. Reviewing case law, prepping a witness. And those videos always had, they didn't go viral, but they always had like 10, 15,000 views. And people are like, this is cool. Do more of this.
Yeah.
And so
I watched a couple of those. They're very
I remember the original one. It was a landlord tenant issue before the régie, the administrative tribunal, the rental board is what it's called. And those videos, people were always interested in it. And it was fun to do. And I could merge my editing. I could merge some humor and I could merge some substance. And so started doing more of those. And then one day, I think it's 2018, Alex Jones deposition. I had no idea, the notoriety of Alex Jones at the time. I just know what I hear in the media. This guy's crazy. He admits having a psychotic episode during his deposition. And I was like, oh, okay, the media is talking about this deposition, but they're all only showing literally a 3-second clip. So I go to YouTube. I watch the 3.5-hour deposition. And I have an aha moment, although I had, one a couple years earlier with Trump and the way the media treated him. But I was like, oh, they're all a bunch of idiots. They're either liars or they have never watched the source material. And so I say, I'm just going to break down this 3-hour deposition, explain what I can. It's Texas procedure, Texas law. I don't really know what that is, but I presume it's roughly the same as Quebec. At least strategy of law will be, pretty much consistent regardless of peculiarities of procedure. I do a 25-minute totally cringe on the roof of my house wearing sunglasses breakdown. And that goes quasi-viral. That got like a couple hundred thousand views before YouTube took it down for allegedly violating terms of service for hate speech. Mm-hmm. Then I discover my ikigai, my niche. I've got legal training. I've got editing skills. I've got a decent sense of humor, and I'm mildly insightful. And that's all that people really need to understand the law and the world of you know, the world of law around them. And I also discovered YouTube censorship. I discovered, you know, how the soft censorship works. But that was basically the catalyst. I was like, okay, this is the thing. This is what I can do in life. And, you know, then I do that for a couple of years, try to remain not neutral, but I still didn't want to make enemies at the time. I could give analysis and withhold my own opinion. Over time, got a little bit more bold in terms of sharing my opinion. Then COVID hit. World went crazy. There was no shortage of law stuff to explain. And I realized that I'm going to make enemies whether or not I share my opinion. And sometimes by not sharing my opinion, I'll make enemies. So if I'm going to make enemies, it's going to be by expressing what I truly believe shamelessly and remorselessly. And if I make enemies for it, well, you know, if you're going to make enemies, at least make the right ones.
Mm-hmm. I read a piece on you that was published in Forbes called From Lawyer to YouTuber, How David Freiheit Found His Niche. And then, of course, the big change for you seems to have come around COVID. So was that the sort of the genesis of Viva Fry as a concept was out of COVID?
Well, actually, the Forbes article was by Carl Moore, who, you know, is an old friend. Well, not an old friend, but we met and he discovered what I did. The genesis was more 2018 doing, you know, legal analyses, just breaking things down, explaining things that were going on in the world. I remember, can't remember the dates of Jussie Smollett, but I remember when Jussie Smollett was arrested and then, you know, that charges dropped, pre-trial diversion.
About 2020, 2021 was when the trial was.
It was, these charges happened well before COVID.
Yes.
But bottom line. So like, I'm like, what the hell's pre-trial diversion? If I don't know what pre-trial diversion is, chances are more people out there don't. So that was where I started doing shorter breakdowns. When COVID hit, it was the genesis of the vlog, the VLAWG to some extent. That's when I started sitting in my car making videos because I'm locked in my house with three
kids. A lot of people have seen those.
Oh yeah, no. I mean that's where it became a gimmick, you know, a shtick. But it started off out of necessity, and then things become what's the word? Pillars of not marketing, but you know, they become brand. And so the crazy dude in his car, because I can't make videos at my house because I got three screaming kids and two barking dogs. And so that's when the car vlog started. But then, you know, COVID kept on going. I started doing live streams with Robert Barnes, the lawyer with whom I do the Sunday night show, who was also, oddly enough, Alex Jones's lawyer in that original deposition video. And I didn't put that together until after we had met. That's when we started doing longer format stuff like interviews and live streams, because, you know, I could do the short vlogs in the car, but I'm still stuck in the house. And then, you know, what was really the catalyst into a broader audience was the Ottawa protest, which nobody knew what that was going to turn into, but especially me. I had no idea.
And you were there, right?
And the way that happened is I had gone to, we're all locked down in curfew in Quebec, literally curfew. I started walking the streets at night with my dog because I was allowed to leave the house after 8 o'clock. And I was doing these walking, talking on the street videos just to give everybody, like, you know, day one of curfew, this is what's going on in commie Quebec within the broader commie Canada. And I had no idea this protest was being organized, this convoy. And people in the chat, you know, saying, Viva, why aren't you covering the convoy? Are you part of the controlled opposition? Without getting into, you know, people sort of manufacture their own conspiracies. But I was like, I have no idea what you're talking about, because in as much as I'm connected, I'm not connected to 24/7 to everything in the world. And I discovered what was going on with the convoy, discovered how the media was, again, lying about it, you know, referring to another convoy in British Columbia, a small one, about weather conditions and road conditions. And then CBC finally had to admit this bigger, broader convoy coming to Ottawa. But still, I didn't really appreciate what it was, what it was going to be, in as much as anybody ever could. I go to Florida to attend a Project Veritas event. And then people are texting me and messaging me like, Viva, what the hell are you doing in Florida? Get your butt to Ottawa. You won't believe what's going on here. So I get back the Sunday or the Monday after the convoy arrived in Ottawa. And I see what the media is saying about the convoy. So you've gone through that, what the media says about Trump in 2016, and people start getting their red pill moments. Then I see how the media treated Alex Jones in 2018, how YouTube soft censored and hard censored, you know, stuff that they didn't want to talk about. Then I see the way the media is now depicting this protest in Ottawa. Nazi flags, people urinating on the cenotaph, desecrating the Terry Fox Memorial. And I'm like, and people are messing with me. Like, they're saying, this is all absolute patent lies. I was like, well, how can one be saying A and reality be not A? I was like, I'm going down. I'll drive down. Montreal's 2.25 hours from Ottawa. I'll drive down and live stream it. Had never really done this before. I say, if we see people, you know, desecrating the cenotaph, destroying monuments, marching around with Nazi flags, if we see it, if it's there, we're going to see it in real time. And I was as nervous as anybody else that I was actually going to see that. But again, I'm there as an observer and not there to frame things. And I get down there and then I just see, like, then you have the aha moment. Holy crap. It's as bad as anybody ever thought it was. It's worse. And then you see the impact that, you know, the initial impressions have. Some people still believe those lies. So I get down there on the day one, 5 hours. And the first day was, I mean, I wasn't measuring the numbers as a success. I was doing this regardless. First day, I don't know, several thousand people watching. Go back the next day, you know, 10,000 people watching. By the peak of the protest, it had gotten an international momentum. Anyway, I remember at one point on YouTube alone, there were 50 some odd thousand people watching live. Just incredible. Watching me walk around and talk to the people who are protesting. And that was like, you know, when things, the channel, commentary, what I do got bumped to the next level. And it's the need for what I think is unfiltered, I say objective, but accurate analysis, even if I do have strong opinions, the need has only gotten stronger. And the need to push back against the absolute dishonesty of the media has also only gotten stronger. Yeah.
So true. And so there sort of was the beginnings of Viva Fry. I watched an interview you did with Ezra Levant, where you talked about some of the things that were going on during COVID and the things that really people are trying to forget, but they can't because they were so bad. What this may seem sort of obvious, but what were the things that were going on during COVID, during what we call the pandemic now, that so offended you and troubled you that you felt the need to broadcast them and really to, you know, dedicate your career to exposing? What were the things that troubled you so much about that time?
Everybody knows this. For the first 2 weeks, I'm a neurotic hypochondriac to begin with. So someone tells you we're all going to be dead and they're digging trenches because there's so many people are dying in New York. Like I'll panic too. I'll panic right up until the point where they lock the outdoor dog run for dogs. And like that was in early April. I'm like, this doesn't make sense anymore. and then all at once, like, okay, locking the dog run doesn't make sense. Chaining up the swings doesn't make sense. Boarding off basketball nets doesn't make sense. So after the initial panic wears off, I was like, okay, none of this makes sense. Then you start having articles in the New York Times saying, well, you know, you can protest for BLM because that racism is a public health emergency. I'm gonna gag, not because, you know, to undermine racism, whatever anybody wants to, you know, deem to be institutionalized racism. The idea that racism is a public health emergency that can warrant protests or justify protests, which would otherwise be qualified as mass spreader events if politically disfavored groups do it. It was stupid beyond words. So that trying to rationalize, the double standards was one of, you know, conceptually one of the bigger issues. Mm-hmm. In Quebec, I remember it. The dog run being locked was the number, one of the number ones. Having our politicians tell us what we need to socially distance, that we cannot have more than another family, you know, that we can't have people in our homes. I forget exactly how the progression was. That you had François Legault, the premier of Quebec, for anybody who doesn't know, he's a fascist dictator who only got rewarded for his tyranny, set that aside, telling us that we're going to celebrate Christmas differently this year, that we're not going to go to church and you're not going to have AA meetings and you're not going to have religious gatherings and you got to be alone, indoors, don't exercise, don't go outside. I mean, I will not swear on your channel, but they cannot go to hell fast enough. And no, I will not forgive and forget ever. Mm-hmm. Whether or not I forgive for my own sanity internally, because holding grudges is not healthy. They were, and will always remain monsters for what they did. But telling the elderly, stay at home and stay alone, And it's not, you know, at some point after a couple of weeks, once the panic wears off and once you have sufficient data, which they did from early on, you know it's wrong. And it was clearly morphed into an absolute power grab to reshape, recondition society. So being told to celebrate Christmas alone, Thanksgiving alone, churches are closing down. Those were one of them. The curfew was, you know, not the end of it for me, because I had already had my, I'd reached my wit's end before that, the curfew. And then the clincher for me to say, I'm getting the F out of this effing tyrannical province, was the COVID, the QR code, the COVID passports, or the vaccine passports.
Yes.
Where, I mean, I'm not sure that other provinces got this far. There was a vaccine passport in Quebec. You had to download an app and show a QR code. And I said, I took two shots, and I'm neither proud nor ashamed of it. And just, you know, but for the grace of God, I seem to be fine. You know, unlike many other people who I know personally, directly and indirectly, I got two shots. I never downloaded that app, and I refused to show my effing papers to go into a coffee shop. I wouldn't go to restaurants that were requiring it. I wouldn't go. I went to Canadian Tire when they imposed this, and, you know, tried to document it in real time. I remember once I, in as much as I was forced to show it, I took my kid, my two kids and their two friends bowling, and I get to the bowling alley. This is Rose Bowl Lanes in Montreal. It's Quai Plus now, and they wouldn't let me in with four little kids unless I showed my papers. That was the one and only time, and I felt dirty, ashamed for having done it. But the decision, whether or not anybody wants to call me a coward, I wasn't going to traumatize, or, you know, traumatize four kids who are not going to understand what's going on, and two of them are not even mine, for my own political beliefs. That was the one and only time I felt dirty. But that that vaccine passport and the QR code, and I got a 12-year-old kid at the time who we're made, you know, we didn't expose to this. And I'm like, she turns 13, she's not going to be able to play soccer. I'm not going to go into a coffee shop. Oh, if the mandates are still in effect, as if by removing them, you somehow undo, you know, mitigate the evil that you inflicted a year ago.
Right.
That was the clincher for me. I knew I was going to have to leave that province as of that moment. And then it took me about a year to plant the seed, first by way of humor, and then by way of reality check with my wife and kids. And we ended up in Florida, at least temporarily.
One of the things that's troubling to me, and I'm interested to get your take on this, is that the perpetrators of all of this evil, you know, the Dr. Fauci's and Theresa Tams and Justin Trudeau's and whoever you want to name, seem to have gotten away with it. There really has not been, apart from some examples like Jason Kenney, who we got rid of in Alberta, thankfully, there hasn't been really the sort of broad and sweeping justice that we would expect for people who had done something that really, in living memory, is probably the worst thing that has ever been inflicted upon the public in North America. Does this trouble you? And is this part of what you're working towards with your show, with the programming that you produce?
Well, whether or not they've suffered professional consequences, they haven't. Whether or not they've suffered legal consequences, they haven't. But I can't think of any greater torture on this earth than to not be able to walk among your brethren. I mean, yeah. Anthony Fauci, I'm not, there is no condoning public harassment, period.
Right.
He is loathed by everyone. So just like Trudeau, you can't walk the streets, no longer a politician of the people. Loathed and detested. I can't imagine a greater living hell than that.
Yeah.
That being said, the legal process is far from over, and I do think a change in leadership and proper investigations might change things. Mm-hmm. But no, I mean, look, I'm not a religious person, but sometimes I want to be. What's the verse of the Bible? What good are all the riches of the earth for he who has forsaken his soul?
Right.
Good. I mean, Fauci, he'll live in his fenced-in area. Bill Gates, he'll live in his fenced-in area. Trudeau will live with his constant security because he's such a detested human being. He can't walk the streets without getting heckled. Whether or not there's going to be Nuremberg 2.0 type trials, I started off very slowly. I did not use that hashtag for a little while. I didn't use crimes against humanity as a concept. I was not slow to get there, and not giving the benefit of the doubt to get there, but just needed the requisite evidence to make those bombastic is not the word, but, you know, those are serious accusations, and those are serious positions to take.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
So I wasn't getting there lightly or prematurely, but I am thoroughly there now. Mm-hmm. And you know, when you have the Anthony House Fathers of the world, basically admitting in real time how they experimented on humans, why they did it, why they immunized or indemnified the pharma companies for their admitted real-time human experimentation, shoddy manufacturing. They should stand legal consequences, legal proceedings. When you have Obama up there proudly saying, "Well, we've basically clinically tested on billions of people," yeah, that is a Nuremberg Code violation. Yeah. But whether it's, oh, well, nobody forced you to take this jab. Oh, no. Nobody forced us, except those who were forced out of their job if they didn't do it, except for those who were terrorized into doing it, except for those who were duped into doing it because they were given false warranties and representations in terms of efficacy, in terms of safety, in terms of what it was even intended to do when they were duped into getting it. That's called coercion. In some cases, it might even be extortion. I have a legal theory that could qualify as battery to some extent. But nobody chose to do that, few people chose to do that in full awareness of fact and law, because we were not made fully aware in fact and law of the facts of that jab. And Now they slowly release it afterwards and expect everyone just to be happy to get back to their regular lives. No, I'm thoroughly on the Nuremberg 2.0, and people should go to trial for this. I was going to say people should go to hell, yes, but I think they're going there anyhow. But yeah, I forget what the question was, but no, I will never forgive it. I will sure as hell never forget, because you cannot. I'm also beyond the point of being shy about drawing analogies to Nazi Germany. Never again meant something. Never again, and it's not never again if you don't remember the lesson and you don't continually remind people of the lesson. Mm-hmm, they destroyed lives. They caused people to kill themselves. They caused people to die, and not just one in a million. Oh, well, that's the random adverse effects from vaccines. They wreaked devastation on millions and millions of people. So it's not trains to camps like it was in Nazi Germany. The numbers, I don't know how, 600,000, a million. It's like when you're comparing genocides by way of numbers, it's like dividing by zero. Oh, well, that one was worse. The Holocaust was worse than the Armenian genocide because it was 6 million to 1.5 million. That argument is absurd. When you're dealing with crimes against humanity, comparing the crimes against humanity is an exercise in absurdity.
Yeah.
What we lived through, in my view, was a known, at first panic, fine. It became a known crime against humanity. And I can only hope that one day there will be political and legal justice.
Mm-hmm. No, I don't think that your comparison with the Nazis is outlandish at all. In fact, an argument could be made. There was a product that the Nazis produced called Pervitin, which they put out to the public and got everybody addicted to it, including pregnant mothers. It turned out to be crystal meth. But coming back to your political statements, one of the things that surprised me when I researched you is that you had a little foray into politics. You actually ran for political office in 2021. That seems a little bit incongruous based upon what we know about you. You seem sort of like an apolitical person outside of the, the establishment. What made you run for politics back in 2021?
Well, it's the same irony as I detest 95% of lawyers. let me rephrase that.
Present company accepted, I hope.
Well, I see there's an exception. There's good lawyers in there, but the expression is the 5% give the, what is it? The 95% give the 5% a bad reputation. Lawyers by and large tend to be very detestable people, as do politicians. And so, going through the practice of law, meeting the gems, and I remember their names and I remember their faces, was always an uplifting event. Right. Politicians are equally scum of the earth. I mean, and probably even more so. And it's not a coincidence that so many politicians used to be lawyers. Never in a million years did I ever think I would run for office. But flip side is, people say, well, you sit in your car whining, why don't you do something about it? Well, first of all, that's not an illegitimate criticism. So I did something about it. I said, before I run from the country, I'm going to run for the country. And it was my requisite political permission slip, so to speak, to finally speak my mind without a filter. And I had the best excuse on earth. I don't care if I hurt your feelings. I'm running for office. I don't care if it's obnoxious. I'm running for office. I don't care if you want to hear it. I'm running for office. And it gave me the freedom to take to Twitter and call out each and every one of these, political scum on a daily basis. You know, people say like, nobody wants to see politics on your Instagram account, your Twitter. It's like, oh, well, but I'm running for office, so I have to. I'm sorry. And there was an irrational, optimistic part of me that thought I could possibly win, even though Westmount NDG riding had gone liberal for 30 years with over 50% of the vote going to the Liberals. But I think I made a mark. I think I also, you know, going back to how fake news distorts perception, all that I ever knew of the People's Party of Canada, the PPC, the party with whom I ran, was that they were racist, anti-Semites, bigots, because, you know, some 2018 hit piece on Maxime Bernier. Mm-hmm. And then I realized that they're not. I mean, then you realize that you're being lied to, and that the only party in Canada, and I'm saying this, you know, I take heat for it because everybody says the PPC is the vote splitter between the Conservatives.
I'm a member. Max Bernier has been on the show. I quite agree with you here. So.
No, he's the only politician, for good or for bad, because it might mean that he's a bad politician, that is principled and doesn't bend his politics to the whim of the people, to the political tides, to the political wind. Yeah. And mm-hmm. I'm not right wing. Although, you know, internet says I'm far right. I get called a Nazi, which is ironic. I would say I'm a constitutionalist. I believe in God-given rights. Mm-hmm. And the PPC was the only party from beginning, before it was popular to do it, saying none of this makes sense. You can't go and devastate a generation of kids because of unknowns. They're like, well, we don't know how bad this virus is going to be, so we got to lock it. It's like, no, you don't do that based on unknowns. You can only do that based on the most concrete, definitive evidence as to necessity. Nobody was doing it. The Conservatives, you know, like they say, are liberals going the speed limit. So the PPC was the only party that I could possibly run with. It allowed me to get out there and really say what I thought. And look, also from my own spiritual perspective, to the extent that I ever thought I was going to leave Canada, well, I no one's going to blame me for not trying. I got the message out and people made their decisions, and I'm not prepared to live in a country and certainly not a province that believes in kicking kids off soccer fields because they didn't get an experimental shot, which is what happened to friends of my daughter. And that's not mm-hmm. something I'm ever going to let my kids think is normal, tolerable, or that I'm going to put up with by living there. Mm-hmm. My kids were in the it's not a second cup anymore. It's called Avenue G on Green Avenue, a coffee shop. And I send them in, I wait in the car. They come back and they're like, yeah, Dad, we just saw two people fighting because they were standing too close to each other. Mm. And I think, what happened? It's like this, I forget if it was a young guy, like a middle-aged man yelling at an elderly lady and with using expletives because she wasn't socially distanced from him. I was like, mm-hmm. this is not a life that I'm going to let my kids think is normal. And mm-hmm. it's one of the more jarring memories when we sold everything, went to live with my parents, packed up that trailer that I got from Martin Swiss Bike Shop and drove to the States. On the way down, we get to New York, we cross the border, and we're at a hotel, and we're getting into the hotel with the kids, the dogs, on the drive down to Florida. And my kids were reluctant to get into an elevator because there was somebody else in there, not because they were afraid, mm-hmm. but because they were afraid of what that person was going to react like. And it's like, right. Dude, we're back in, well, I mean, not that New York's a sane society, but we're back in a more sane society. We're out of Quebec, and you don't need to worry about getting in an elevator with people anymore as to how they're going to react. Yeah.
Unfortunately, this assault on freedom, as you know, because you talk about this a lot on your show, has not ended. In fact, in a lot of ways, it's gotten worse. One of the recent assaults, of course, is with the Liberals, the federal Liberals, and their new Online Harms Act. I'm sure that you've looked at this, but essentially the Justice Center for Constitutional Freedoms has a petition that they've started that has over 50,000 signatures trying to stop this. But of course, it would mark essentially the end of free speech in Canada. Some of the features are you can pocket $20,000 if you inform on your neighbor. You can destroy people's lives by sending them to jail or imposing incredible fines of $50,000 and up. It can be weaponized as a tool to be used against political enemies in Canada, much like Mr. Trump has been exposed to the United States. Really just an awful bill. What do you have to say about this Online Harms Act and where it's taking us?
We'll go back a little bit. You know, when you say that not only has the assault on freedoms not gotten better, it's gotten worse. It has, because the government has learned all of the wrong lessons, and the people have not learned the right lessons. Oh. Whip people into a panic, and you can jam through whatever emergency order you want. Whip people into a panic, you can jam through whatever legislation you want. And they've learned how to do it very, very deceitfully, and above all else, quickly and stealthily, I would say. Under COVID, they crammed through that order in council outlawing 1,500 types of long arms, rifles. Under COVID, they jammed through the Online Streaming Act. Under COVID, they jammed through, what was the other one? The Link Tax Act.
Right.
In the dead of night, you know, they're having these debates while the world is still, or I'll just say at least Canada is still reeling from and subjected to the consequences of their insane and unconstitutional COVID response. So the Online Harms Act is just, let's say, the sixth or seventh in a series. You had Bill C-16 before COVID, which is what Jordan Peterson sounded the alarm about, amending right. the criminal code to add gender mm-hmm. identity was going to result in compelled speech. He's proven to have been right beyond his wildest
yes.
nightmare.
Yes.
Then you get the gun laws. You get the most recent gun laws. Then you get Online Streaming Act, where they have now effectively will govern online content the way the government governs radio and television. It's nothing but disguised censorship. Then you had the Link Tax, which was also just another method of disguised censorships, you know, determining which news outlets are going to divvy up the monies now that Google and Meta or Google and Facebook are going to pay to the Canadian government. And now you got the Online Harms Act, which is nothing short of an Orwellian piece of legislation. Yeah. And they also learned that, you know, whip people up into a frenzy, make it a life or death situation. You'll get neighbors to snitch on each other. That CBC article, things that I'll never forget about COVID. The joys and perils of snitching on your neighbor during a pandemic. That's what the CBC ran by way of article. And the only downfall to snitching on your neighbor, according to the CBC article, is that it would affect minorities because people would be more inclined to rat out minorities than white folk. Mm-hmm. The joys and perils of snitching on your neighbors during a pandemic. Well, this legislation here with the Online Harm Act or the Online Harms Act, I mean, it monetizes snitching. Above and beyond the fact that it would create basically retroactive criminality by criminalizing, penalizing, however you want to call it, making sanctionable posts that were posted pre-law, but if you don't delete them and then they get republished, well, then it becomes sanctionable under the law. So it's retroactive in effect. It's financially motivating people to snitch on their neighbors, to further divide and conquer. It empowers these administrative tribunals to basically become political jackpot, you know, political lotteries for the politically favored or the politically disfavored. There's nothing good about it. I mean, and my bottom line is I've asked publicly, you know, the Michael Geists of the world, he's a very intelligent lawyer. You know, what laws don't exist to address the purported concerns that serve as the basis for this Online Harms Act? You know, they want to go after pornography, child exploitive material. As far as I understood, there were already laws about that. Now, whether or not it facilitates, I don't know, not preemptive measures, but what's it when you make things go faster? Whether or not it expedites, provides means to expedite a process.
Right.
The problem was never that the social media platforms lacked the means or the legislative requirements to remove child pornography. The only problem was that they didn't do it. So this law, which now seeks to amend the Human Rights Act or the Charter, which seeks to, add insane penalties to define hate. It doesn't do anything to address the underlying problem, and it doesn't explain why there's a need for this new legislation and why existing legislation is not enough. But did you? I mean, you've read the definition of hate under this proposed piece of legislation.
Yes.
It's a freaking. It's a South Park joke, is what it is.
Yeah.
Hate. I mean, it said some. I forget what it is, but you know, not reaching the level of mere repudiation. It's like scorn scorn, but not merely something less than hate. It's it's preposterous. Yeah. And the other bottom line is, call me crazy again, hate speech, what is now being referred to, you know, reflexively as hate speech, is the speech that requires freedom of speech protections, because you don't need to protect love speech. And it's not the favored speech that requires protection. It's the disfavored speech. Mm-hmm. And quite honestly, I'd rather know who hates me because I'm Jewish, or who hates someone because they're black, as opposed to criminalizing it and then making them go further underground and then further solidify the truth of their beliefs. Because look, it's so truthful that they need to make laws to prevent me from saying it.
Mm-hmm. It, and this is in the context of, at least in Canada, and I think also to some extent the United States, where we're seeing a rise, a frightening rise in anti-Semitism, and also in anti-Christian protest. In Canada, we've had over 50 churches burned.
Yeah, and Trudeau doesn't mention it. I think it was over 60 right. in one summer, 2021 mm-hmm. alone, I think, 2022. Mm-hmm.
And anti-Semitism is one of the bellwethers for what we have to be concerned about as what happened in Europe in 1936 when your ancestors left. It's one of the bellwethers. It's a sign that the social fabric is tearing apart. It's a sign of terrible things to come and is very concerning. And yet the government, the state is doing nothing to police that. Which is quite concerning when, if you're a Christian or you're a Jew, you're being told constantly to be tolerant of other religions. And yet there seems to be intolerance aimed at Christians and Jews.
Well, I mean, it's quite, there is an interesting paradox in there, and we're witnessing it in the States, is that when it's the end result of identity politics. When you focus only on identity politics, are you gay, Jewish, Black, Muslim, trans, queer, whatever, when that's all that you do, that ends up actually exacerbating whatever problems you thought you were solving by hyper-focusing or amplifying identity issues. In the States, you know, I often give the ADL, the Anti-Defamation League, a lot of flack because I think, whether or not it's by accident or by design, they actually do more to exacerbate or foment anti-Semitism by constantly focusing on that aspect of the identity.
Right.
There is an element where, you know, focusing on it, screaming it at every street corner actually ends up amplifying it, enacting legislation that creates specific protections for identifiable groups actually amplifies the social division because, I call me radical, all people deserve equal protection, equal rights, and, all crimes deserve equal punishment. When you say, well, some crimes are worse than others because it picks on a person's identity, I happen to not actually agree with that. I think all crime is hate crime. So, but when you spend too much time focusing and amplifying certain types of alleged hate crime, it actually only exacerbates the sentiment of the us versus them in society. But one thing's for certain. I mean, under Trudeau, Canada has never been more socially divided. And it's ironic because he's the peace-loving, tolerant liberal. America really reached its peak racial and identity politics division, coincidentally enough, under Obama, the first, they say he's the first Black president, but he's, as much Black as he is white. People don't like to say that, but it's these political leaders that come in and purport to amplify identity politics for the purposes of social justice and equity. And all they do, and I do believe it's by design and not by accident, is amplify the division. And what we're seeing, whether or not it's anti-Semitism, in its purest or proper form, or just every identity in society now fighting with each other because some feel that others are getting preferential treatment, protection under the law, and others feel like they're being ignored. It's exactly how you destroy the very fabric of society.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned about American politics, and a story that you've been following quite closely on your platform is the First Amendment struggles of people like Alex Jones and, of course, Donald Trump. Why is it that you think that is such an important story for people to know about?
Well, I mean, it's an amazing thing. Going back to the early stages of my channel before I got opinionated, and I remember it, 2016, Bill C-16, when I did my neutral breaking down, the law is bad. And as we say, bad cases make for bad law, but the panic might be premature. Panic might have been premature, but it wasn't wrong. And then people were saying, Viva, you don't have freedom of speech in Canada. You think you do, but you don't. And I never understood it at the time. Then you get to the States and you understand what it's, hate speech is not a thing in the States. And it sounds all big and scary. Oh my goodness. People get to say that they hate identifiable groups of people. If that's the speech is different than action, whether or not speech translates into action, we can have a lot of discussion about that. The action is already outlawed. But once you understand and you see how Americans value freedom of speech and that it, what it allows for, I mean, it allows for protest in a meaningful way, because you say, look, it's the Larry Flints of the world that are going to make you understand the importance of freedom of speech, and not the platitudes that are spouted by the Obamas of the world.
Right.
And so I get down here and you see the attack on the First Amendment in real time. And having come now from Canada, where you see what happens, we don't have a First Amendment, but we damn well have a charter that is not worth the digital paper on which it's written, that protects freedom of speech, except in as much as can be infringed in a free and democratic society, and hate speech is not free speech. Bull crap. Hate speech, unfortunately, is free speech. Now, threats, intimidation are not. Those are already crimes. But hate speech is the type of free speech that needs to be protected in order to ensure that meaningful free speech is never infringed upon. And we're seeing it here in the States. And we're seeing it here in the States because you get Alex Jones coming out and having all of his free speech rights denied, his First Amendment rights and his, you know, press rights or media rights denied, ignored. You have Trump. I mean, it's beyond First Amendment rights being gagged in trials, being having an award of $90 million, $65 million punitive damages, defamation of 12, or well, the defamation was $7 million, the rehabilitation was, this is the E. Jean Carroll case, being ordered to pay tens of millions of dollars for protesting his innocence to what I believe are false accusations of sexual abuse. And you see the way it works. And it's all, it's slow, and then it's all at once. They start with the politically disfavored, and then they apply it to everybody. And then they try to legislate it. Then they try to govern the internet with it. And so we're seeing that battle here in the States, and people fight hard for First Amendment rights in the States. And you understand why, because when you see what happens where they don't, and we're a nice polite society in Canada, but we're a nice muzzled society in Canada. And you know, if you're found guilty of advocating or promoting genocide, whatever the hell that means, you might be facing life in prison. So compare where Canada is to where the US could go if it follows the same route. So I mean, it's probably the most important battle to fight for, the freedom to talk and the freedom to think, because if you control language, you control thought itself.
Yes, so true. And of course, speech is the one right that you can use back to win all the others. And I guess what you're saying, it sort of echoes what John Milton wrote about in Areopagitica. You probably remember that from your philosophy degree, where he said, essentially, if we cannot speak in a way that could risk offense to someone else, we really can never have any kind of meaningful conversation. And be, if we have to risk offending someone else, we can't learn from each other, you know. And we can have, we used to be able to have difficult conversations where we could risk offending each other, but we could do it in a civil way. And as someone in media, you've seen this sort of disappear, haven't you? There really are not shows like that anymore, are there?
No, well, they basically, I mean, you see it in Canada, they take a well-meaning and at first properly applied hate speech, death to fill in the blank. Okay, look, whether or not it's a call to action and actionable under criminal law, okay, fine. That's the speech that we're going to block under hate speech. And then you get to, 20 years later, where all people have to do is like, say hate speech and I'll shut you up. Oh, what's that? You think that gender-affirming care is child genital mutilation? Hate speech. Oh, you think that by saying that minors should not be able to have undergo hormone replacement therapy? Well, that's genocide. You're denying the right to exist of trans people. I mean, so you see how it's, you know, they pass legislation, frame it as well-meaning, and then as everything happens over time, the slippery slope is not a fallacy, it's a strategy. And it's just the way it happens. And then they find that you can abuse of these terms to shut people up and to push, I mean, morally offensive and morally objectionable policy. And you realize, yeah, that's it. Look, and then you realize, well, we shouldn't have given them the first step. And okay, death to fill in the blank, it's bad. Incidentally, I'd like to know who says it so I can know to avoid them. but it's bad, but you have to tolerate that bad, because if you don't, the day is going to come where you're going to say, son, you're not a girl. And in Quebec, in Canada, it could be hate speech. It could be warned for taking your child away under that law that they just passed in Quebec, which removed parental supremacy from the Youth Protection Act. So if the government comes in and says, you denying your child's gender existence is genocide or is whatever, we take your kid away from you, that's where it goes. And so you got to take the bad in order to have the good. And that does mean, you know, being realistic about speech, being realistic about things. When speech crosses a line, we already had the the measures in place. Defamation is not legal. Threats are not legal. Extortion is not legal. These are, fraud is not legal. These are all word crimes. We already had the measures in place. What you end up having is just ever encroaching government control so they can shut people up and criminalize dissent.
Mm-hmm. Well, David, I must say you are very aptly named because you're standing up to giants. This has been a very illuminating conversation. We're so grateful to grab an hour of your time. I know you're incredibly busy with your show and your media, everything that you're doing. We end off our program with something called the reading list. I'm interested to hear a couple of selections from you, if you'd provide them. It doesn't have to be a book, could be a website or something else that you think would, you know, help people understand better what you're all about and some of the topics that you are discussing here and also on your platform. The two books that I'm going to recommend today, you might be familiar with. One is called The Great Awakening, Defeating the Globalists and Launching the Next Great Renaissance. This is a book written by Alex Jones with some help, but the expression get woke, go broke has entered the common lexicon as we've seen company after company invoke the false gods of diversity, equity, and inclusion to their financial demise. But this surface discussion masks a much darker truth. And he says, what we are witnessing is nothing less than the failed plans of social Darwinists to capture free market capitalism and turn it toward their fascist aims of controlling and depopulating the globe. This is a very fascinating book just released. And if you're a fan of Alex Jones, and many of us are, a very controversial figure that whom David has talked about a lot, you know, I would check out this book.
Once you get to know the people, you realize that the people you thought were the most controversial are actually probably the most sane. And then when the people you thought were the coolest turn out to be the biggest pervs.
We can say the same about you. You're very controversial.
I'm controversial. I mean, it's ridiculous. They have to demonize the good to try to turn them into the evil that they are. I mean, I've discovered in real time. And the people who I grew up thinking were the baddies, you know, some of them are objectively bad. You don't need the media to tell you that. But the ones that have been demonized by the media end up being the most sane and the most logical and the least demonic.
Yeah, very, very true. The second book is one also just released at the end of last year. It's called The War on Conservatives. It's by Mark Dice. This is another really interesting book. And the description is conservatives are under attack on numerous different fronts by a well-funded, highly organized Marxist movement. The war is being waged in the public schools and universities in corporate America, Canada as well, the media, and in the streets. And it talks about the attack on symbols and holidays, Christianity and churches, and even the nuclear family itself is under siege. And David has talked about that today. LGBTQ extremists are preying on children while white people are being systemically demonized by critical race theory, which is just anti-whiteism in disguise. And millions of illegal aliens have been allowed to invade countries like Canada and the United States. And so this book really is designed to sort of make us aware of the war that's being waged on us. And really, you could say that COVID was sort of the beginnings of it. And we've talked today with our guest about the progression and why it's so important to stand up and stop this. But the beginning of it is being aware of what's happening. We can't stop something until we wake up to it. And time is running short. Now is the time. And I think that's sort of the message of this book. So I'd recommend those two. They're being added to our reading list. And with that, we'll hand it over to our guest and listen to his selections.
I'll limit it to five, but only because I haven't read the Bible through cover to back. But I go for the verses because I have a short attention span. And the Bible is... Once you realize that it's nothing more and nothing less, and it's what it is the amalgamation of human experience put into a book over thousands of years, and humans haven't changed much in thousands of years, and the morals and the principles in the stories of the Bible are mutatis mutandis, as applicable today as they were 5,000 years ago, 3,000 years ago. And there's verses in there that, you know, they stick with me. What good is all the wealth of the world for he who has forsaken his soul? So set aside the classic. My ideological Bible, 1984. It's not just a must. It's a must. If you haven't read it, and if you haven't read it recently, absolutely read it. An oldie classic that hasn't aged well because of what's happened to the author, Manufacturing Consent, Noam Chomsky. You know, it's dated, but the and the stories in it might not be not relevant, but of interest to people. But once you understand how the media has been manipulated or was always manipulated, it doesn't come as a surprise to how they do it now. It's just that the medium has changed. Mm-hmm. So it's boring. A lot of the chapters are very dated stories that people might not care about today. But the underlying message as to how the wrap up smear. I mean, basically, the wrap up fake news is in that book. And then the other one, which is I listened to it and it made me cry as I was listening to it, With the Old Breed. I got to look it up here. It's With the Old Breed by Eugene Sledge, for the Battle of Palelu, at Palelu in Okinawa. It's about Eugene Sledge's experience having survived the most horrific horrific war imaginable. And it's not that it puts things in perspective, like, oh, don't complain because other people had to go through worse. It is the illustration of what happens when madness takes over, and you know, and the citizens are used as the pawns for the stupidity of those in charge. And it'll blow your mind as to what people actually went through, and how society can devolve into absolute madness, where humans become fodder for battle. They're no longer individuals. They're army ants used for tactical purposes that, at the end of the day, what does it lead to? What did it produce? But it's a horrifying story to read, and it's just it's as real as the atrocities of the world get. It'll rattle anybody who hasn't read it yet. But those are my picks.
Those sound fascinating. I mentioned if you're going to read 1984, I'd recommend that people always also read as a companion Aldous Huxley's Brave New World. Because I quite agree with you about George Orwell, but there are elements of Huxley's vision which are also there. It's almost what we're living through is almost like a blend of those two visions, dystopian visions. And of course, two men were friends. One was a mentor student. Huxley was older, and he actually, there's a story there. I don't know if you know this, but actually Orwell sent the manuscript of 1984 to Huxley to review. And he thought it was quite good, but there was a relationship there, and so it's interesting those two very prescient authors that envisioned something that was going to happen, you know, in the 21st century and really shaped the early 21st century. That they were both writing, they both wrote these sort of.
Interesting. I'm going to go back and see what the YouTube video was, but there was a video of someone analyzing. You know, what the future has become. Has it become Aldous Huxley's vision of what the future would be versus what George Orwell thought the future would be? And, you know, it turns out that it's actually like a perfect blend.
It is.
I'm going to go back. I have to refresh my memory on Brave New World, because that one, I've, you know, my go-to is 1984. It's just.
Yeah, it is. But Huxley's book is more about soft totalitarianism, which is kind of some of the things that you were talking about. That we're experiencing right now sort of fit into that category. But in any event, those are brilliant selections, and we thank you so much for that. And more importantly, we thank you so much for sharing this time with us. We know your time is very precious with everything that you're doing. We just wish you much continued success with Viva Fry and all of the important work that you're doing, really in defense of free speech and natural freedoms and natural rights, which are not talked about enough in our public discussions, in our public fora. But of course you do that so well, and we're so grateful for your time here today. So thanks so much for being our special guest here today on Gray Matter.
Thank you very much for having me.